This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and five focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
Jesse Jackson was a good man. He fought for us. Him and Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Rush, they all fought for us. And as well, everybody, the Rainbow Coalition, that it didn't matter what color you was. He fought for everybody. For rights, civil rights.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Don't forget to stick around to the end of the episode to get the latest news from around the Chicago area. But first, Reverend Jesse Jackson will forever be remembered as one of the most influential people in the fight for civil rights and racial equality. But it's critical to remember that he was also a queer ally, ahead of his time, who fought on behalf of the community when it wasn't popular or politically advantageous. In Jackson's speech at the 1984 Democratic National Convention, while he was running for president, he explicitly talked about protecting the LGBTQ community.
Rainbow includes lesbians and gays. No American citizen ought to be denied equal protection under the law. We must be unusually committed and caring as we expand our family to include new members. All of us must be tolerant and understanding as the fears and anxieties of the rejected and the party leadership express themselves in many different ways.
Jackson spoke up at the 1987 National March on Washington for lesbian and gay rights. And for years, his advocacy continued, including a push in 2010 to repeal California's ban on gay marriage. So as we continue to reflect on the lasting impact of the late Reverend Jackson, we dig into his efforts to stand up for marginalized groups and discuss what advocacy for the LGBTQ community in the political sphere looks like today. At the table, we had Martha Biondi, who's the Lorraine H. Morton Professor of Black Studies and History at Northwestern University, and Shannon Lynn Parker, who's CEO of Equality Illinois. On Tuesday, we spoke to Chicago Sun-Times columnist Natalie Moore and Trinity United Church of Christ senior pastor Reverend Otis Moss III. We started off by listening to a bit of what they had to say about Reverend Jackson's work to platform issues that weren't always popular.
He had been championing Palestinian rights for decades. He spoke out against apartheid. You know, he was inclusive of LGBTQ plus people. And that might sound very basic right now, but in the 1980s, it was not.
There was an entire work and connected with Operation Breadbasket that moves into Operation Push, which was pushing for the inclusion of women, Black people, Latino and Asians on Fortune 500 boards. He was an environmental activist before environmental activists were popular. Right. Bernie Sanders' platform is nothing but a redux of Jesse Jackson's.
Here's Professor Biondi.
I'm very happy to be here. And first, I'd like to express my condolences to Reverend Jackson's family and his wide circle of friends and comrades in Chicago. He was a treasured figure here for his very, very robust solidarity for so many communities and issues and causes. I want to kind of just offer some background. I think more than anyone else in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Reverend Jackson really carried forward the vision and banner of Dr. King, who at the end of his life offered very forceful critiques of what he termed the three evils of American life. The fact that there was such a high poverty rate in such a wealthy nation, militarism, specifically the war in Vietnam, and what was coming to be called institutional racism. Reverend Jackson consistently advocated for poor Americans. He stressed workers' rights and emphasized the role of unions in helping to create pathways to the middle class for Black and white workers. Mm-hmm. Moreover, Jesse Jackson became a vocal and consistent critic of U.S. military intervention, especially in the Global South, and then in later years in Iraq, Afghanistan, and across the Middle East. So I think he became a voice for respecting the autonomy and sovereignty of the Global South. So this is just an example of the expansiveness of his vision. You know, Natalie Moore talked about Palestinian rights, gay rights. He was a pioneer.
Yeah.
He was a feminist.
And these topics back then, it was like, wow, you're speaking out on national stages about this?
Yes, I think a key role that Reverend Jackson played was to bring the issues that were percolating up in social movements, issues on the activist left, into mainstream politics. And he did this certainly in both his 1984 presidential run and his 1998 presidential run.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, 1988 presidential.
That's right, right, right. Yes. Right. Yeah, he was the first presidential candidate to platform rights for the LGBTQ community. A lot was happening at the time, too, in the community. They were struggling with, you know, HIV/AIDS epidemic, mm-hmm. discrimination, homophobia, a lack of representation, Shannon. Talk more about how throughout all of that, Jackson was rising their issues to the top.
Absolutely. So when we really think about it, Reverend Jackson understood that liberation that excludes is in fact stale and is no liberation at all. I love that in 1984 at the DNC, he talked about it being a quilt, which also, as we saw, included at that time lesbian and gay folks as well. He understood that if civil rights is selective, if justice excludes anybody, then it's incomplete, right? So in thinking about that in the 80s, especially when we're talking about the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis, mm-hmm. where LGBTQ folks were being pointed at, blamed, he said, no, absolutely not. Because, again, he understood that that injustice was going to ultimately be a threat to so many other folks.
You're right. And here's the other piece, Shannon. He was a reverend.
Yes, it wasn't
common at the time for you to see religious leaders stand up in support of gay rights.
No.
Right?
That's right.
Why do you think it was so significant then to see not just a political figure, but a religious figure championing the issue?
Because faith leaders shape moral language in this country. So many of the ills that we see that plague the LGBTQ community in terms of how they see themselves, in terms of their life expectancies, in terms of what care and support look like, come from moral religious institutions. So he understood that he had a responsibility, a moral imperative, especially when we talk about the Black church, that he used his platform respectfully and wisely, also recognizing that some of those folks who were intertwined in that community, the church community, mm-hmm. also had family members who were suffering from said conditions as well.
Right? That's it. Yeah.
Yes.
Professor, you know, you talked about how he had become such a pioneer of the progressive movement. What kind of response was Reverend Jackson getting for supporting gay rights at the time?
Well, he was, you know, in some ways, and I'm going to just focus on the 1980s now when he ran for president.
Sure.
In some ways, it was reminiscent of what happened to Harold Washington when he ran for mayor in 1983. He encountered incredible racial vitriol and slights and insults and disrespect. And looking back at some of how the Democratic Party leaders and how the media just reacted and responded to Jesse Jackson, it's really striking to see how much they wanted to sort of diminish his horizons, not take him seriously, marginalize him, and all of the issues and voices that he was trying to bring to the fore. So when he announced his campaigns, I mean, the media would say, like, is he electable? What does Jesse want? That was a constant refrain over and over again, as if this wasn't a sincere campaign, but some kind of backroom hustle. And in fact, that stereotype plagued him across the 1980s, that he was just a seeker of media attention. He was a showman. He wasn't serious. You know, is he electable? And I think that you know, and the media also often called him arrogant, flashy, brash, not humble. You know, and I think today we can see these as obvious kind of racial constructs. They were very, very prevalent at the time. And I think that Reverend Jackson got a lot of pushback because he was not only trying to assertively and forcefully speak against Reaganomics and speak against the right-wing political moves that the Reagan administration had made in domestic policy and foreign policy, but he was speaking to his own leadership and criticizing the Democratic Party.
That's right.
For taking Black voters for granted, for taking marginalized voters for granted, for taking LGBT voters for granted, without actually speaking to their voice, their concerns, their issues, and their needs. And Reverend Jackson was all about renegotiating the relationship between the base, who was just taken for granted, and the party's leadership that was trying, that in Jackson's eyes, and I think correctly, was too accommodationist toward Reagan and trying to placate the Reagan regime.
So how's the legacy of this work in the queer community still felt today, Shannon?
Well,
let's fast forward to 2026 from the 80s.
He helps to normalize that LGBTQ equality is not separate from racial justice. You know, to believe that they are separate is rather obtuse, I would say. And that looks like economic justice. That looks like voter rights. It's all a part of the same struggle, right? It overlaps. When we talk about reproductive justice, we're talking about bodily autonomy. We're talking about civil unions, marriage equality. We are talking about, we can go back and look at Loving versus Virginia. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many things that Reverend Jackson saw during his lifespan, well before he began to advocate for civil rights, that he saw the intertwining and the connection.
Yeah, before he got that big platform.
Absolutely, yeah.
I want to go back, Professor, to something that we heard earlier from Reverend Moss. He said on Tuesday, he said, quote, Bernie Sanders' platform is nothing but a redux of Jesse Jackson's. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think he paved the way. You know, people often say he paved the way for Barack Obama. He paved the way for Bernie Sanders. You know, he was a true economic populist in a progressive fashion in the 1980s. As I mentioned earlier, he was really alarmed by Ronald Reagan's, you know, hike in military spending, mm-hmm. his cut of corporate taxes. You know, there was a big increase in homelessness and unemployment in the 1980s. And Jesse Jackson offered a stark alternative. In 1984, he put forward what was known as the People's Platform. It called for decreased military spending. It called for a single-payer universal health care.
Just the name alone of that platform. Can we sit in that for just a moment?
Yep.
The People's Platform. Back then?
Mm-hmm.
We know what the focus would be.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, another way that I think the party and the press tried to marginalize Jackson was to say, well, you're just speaking for a small minority community. These are Black issues. These aren't American issues. And I think one thing that Jackson did that Bernie Sanders very much tried to do was to say, no, these aren't special interests, small minority concerns, decent health care, affordable housing. These are majority concerns. These are concerns of the multiracial working class.
Right.
And it was that constituency that Reverend Jackson wanted to really bring into politics. I noticed on your last segment with Alex Janulius, you were talking about the attack on voting rights.
Right.
This was another key focus of Reverend Jackson's campaigns. In contrast to our current party in power that wants to limit the electorate, wants to decrease voting rights, Jackson saw expanding the electorate as central to a robust democratic vision. And just like before Harold Washington ran, before Reverend Jackson ran, he just ensured that there had to be a very vigorous and robust voter registration plan to accompany his campaign.
Yeah.
And between 1982 and 1984, they registered 2 million new Black voters, the largest gain since the 1964 Voting Rights Act.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. Incredible. Shannon Jackson praised former President Barack Obama for supporting same-sex marriage. In a statement after Obama announced his support, Reverend Jackson said, quote, if Dr. King and our civil rights movement have taught us anything, it's the fundamental principle that all people deserve equal protection under the law. LGBT people deserve equal rights, including marriage equality. Discrimination against one group of people is discrimination against all of us.
And again, that's the connective tissue. Discrimination against one group is discrimination against us all. So when President Obama publicly endorsed marriage equality in 2012, we obviously see that it marked a historic shift in the American political landscape, right? And we also know that Reverend Jackson praised Obama's stance, recognizing it as a morally significant and consistent with the expansion of civil rights. We know that Reverend Jackson long argued that justice must evolve, right? It must expand because, again, there are so many identities mm-hmm. who have yet to come to the forefront that we have to continue to follow that blueprint
so
for.
As bold as a statement like this was and just the move to support same-sex marriage in that way, it sounds like we still have work to do.
Oh, my God, yes. We still have work to do, right? The work is never undone. You know, the work continues. We see right now in this current landscape, we need to continue to follow in Jesse Jackson's footprints and so many other folks who played integral positions during the civil rights movement
right.
to ensure that there's protections for all of us.
Let's close our conversation by listening to more of Reverend Jackson at the 1984 DNC.
Too often, what we call hate, as if it were some deeply rooted philosophy or strategy, is simply ignorance, anxiety, paranoia, fear, and insecurity. To be strong leaders, we must be long-suffering as we seek to right the wrongs of our party and our nation. We must expand our party, heal our party, and unify our party. That is our mission in 1984.
And that mission continues to resonate today. We've been talking with Shannon Lynn Parker, who's CEO of Equality Illinois, and Martha Biondi, who's a professor at Northwestern University. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
Now we'll turn to the top stories of the day. From Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget address to the Winter Olympics, WBEZ's Claire Lane, Alex Degman, and Summer Van Benton gave us the latest. Summer started off by telling us about the funeral plans for the late Reverend Jackson.
So first and foremost, condolences to the Jackson family, his village, and all that who feel touched by Reverend. Next Wednesday and Thursday, Reverend Jackson will lie in state at Rainbow Push Coalition. That's on 50th and Drexel in Kenwood. Next Friday, the People's Celebration will be at the House of Hope on 114th in Doty. Saturday is the homegoing service at Rainbow Push Coalition. Again, that's on 50th and Drexel in Kenwood. All of these events start at 10 a.m. Doors open at 9 a.m. And the family welcomes any and all to these events. They actually said at the presser yesterday morning that, if anything, Jackson Sr.'s children, they expressed that they believe their father would want his transition and his homegoing arrangements to catalyze the left, the right, conservatives, liberals, mm-hmm. left wing, right wing, to come together and hash out any differences. Let this be a great meeting,
right.
Jackson Jr. said.
Let me play a little bit of Jackson Jr. because, this is the moment here when he spoke on behalf of the family. Let's hear some from him.
These homegoing services are welcome to all, Democrat, Republican, because his life is broad enough to cover the full spectrum of what it means to be an American.
In summer, he also warned people by saying, quote, do not bring your politics. Is there credible fear that there could be disruption at the service?
Definitely. There always is. And honestly, from my reporting, I learned that Jackson had bodyguards at the home with him on runs. So there is always this looming concern, mm-hmm. and especially considering what's happening in the news and even statements that have been released with his transition, there's always a looming concern. But as you all just heard, Jackson Jr. encouraged this to be a respectful, great meeting, quote, he said directly, for those individuals to come and discuss their differences, to come together and discuss ways of moving forward.
Claire, other reactions to the death of Jesse Jackson?
Right. Respect the ethos of Rainbow Push, right? That is what it stands for, what it represents. As we've been discussing this week, Sasha, people of all walks of life coming out, paying their respects, from Barack Obama to President Trump, which we talked about yesterday, his former campaign secretary on the 1988 ticket on Say More yesterday, average everyday Chicagoans. We've seen immigration rights advocates here in Chicago stepping up, hearing from Lawrence Benito yesterday, the executive director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, you know, speaking about Jackson's continued support for immigrants, also in the sports world, which we've seen this morning. You know, people forget he was offered a football scholarship at U of I.
Oh, that's right.
Ended up becoming an Aggie, was inducted into their Hall of Fame. But he had the same mission in the sports world, too. You know, a deep passion for ensuring that athletes were given equal opportunities in treatment, regardless of their race, gender, sport, or even their native country. So lots of relevant different factions sort of coming out and paying their respects.
Mm-hmm. And Claire, in other news, the statue of Christopher Columbus was removed from Little Italy's Arrigo Park in 2020. It's going to be replaced with what or with whom?
Si, veramente. This is true. You might recall after the murder of George Floyd, civil rights protests erupting across the nation, including here in Chicago, where the Christopher Columbus statue in Arrigo Park was vandalized. A former mayor, Lori Lightfoot, back then directed the removal. And, you know, the city has been trying to find a figure that the Italian-American community has sort of is okay with to replace it. So they've settled on Francis Xavier Cabrini, will soon reside in the place where that Christopher Columbus statue was. The woman known as the patron saint of immigrants will be memorialized there. Cabrini founded more than 60 schools, orphanages, and hospitals before dying here in Chicago in 1917.
Yeah. Alex, the governor's budget address was yesterday. How was that received?
Well, it was a little bit more muted than in recent years, I would say. And the responses were about what you would expect. They did follow along party lines with people like the Illinois Republican Party calling this speech nothing but empty promises, hypocrisy, fear-mongering. You've come to expect that, but the response from Democrats, while it was positive, like I said, it was a little bit more muted because they realized that there is this cloud hanging over the state, this $8 billion plus cloud of lost federal funding from the Trump administration. And they realized that while the governor is putting out some ideas that they agree with and shared sacrifice and priorities and things like that, they realized that this is going to be a really difficult budget year.
Alex, let's play a little bit of Pritzker's plan here for a social media tax. This is what he said.
Social media algorithms have been proven to create mental health issues in adolescents and foster polarization and misinformation in society as a whole. Those companies are profiting from online engagement of Illinois' consumers, and they currently contribute nothing. I propose a social media platform fee that will generate $200 million per year to support K-12 education.
So, you know, he spent a little time around this particular topic, Alex, and sort of led into it by talking about what happens online, you know, the cyberbullying, scams for the elderly, et cetera. And Mayor Johnson, I remember, had proposed something similar in his budget last year.
Right.
It was kind of received at the time as unrealistic. So is the idea of these companies paying their fair share now sort of gaining traction?
I would say it is. And it's been gaining traction slowly over the past few years, I would argue, because more people are online more often and they're starting to realize that, yeah, this is actually a problem, even in adults. It's not just kids. But I would say that now especially, we're hearing about it, especially because of the trial that's going on right now when it relates to Mark Zuckerberg and Instagram.
Yeah.
I just heard about that on NPR this morning on the way in. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is sitting before a court having to answer questions about how Instagram is potentially addictive to kids. So if there's any time for anything like this to gain any sort of traction, this would be the time. Now, with that said, I don't know about the appetite for a tax increase, because there are a couple of issues with that. Governor Pritzker has never really liked the idea of taxes, especially in an election year such as this is, a midterm election as it may be. But there's also just the idea that this could happen because there's momentum, and it could also happen because it's not necessarily broad-based. It's not a sales tax increase. But then there's also the implementation of it. I'm just thinking out loud here, like, how would this be implemented? How would you enforce this?
You're right.
Because we've seen the state try to legislate social media before, and companies like Meta and X, they've just basically said, okay, you can try, but it remains to be seen, because we're entering in what I would say is a new era.
That's difficult to enforce, for sure. I want to turn with you to the race for Illinois' 8th congressional district. Big changes in that district in the northwest suburbs. Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, well, the more things change, the more they stay the same to an extent, because we do have a candidate in that race that may be familiar for some. A lot of you might remember Melissa Bean, who served in the 8th congressional district in the mid-2000s to early 2010s. She's trying to regain her seat, but the issue that is, you know, coming up in the Democratic primary is that that district is really different now. It's been redistricted a couple of times. It's a lot more diverse than it used to be. And there's also the politics aspect of it. We have a northwest suburban district in the Chicago area that could be seen as more moderate, because it went, I believe, 53-46 for Democrat Kamala Harris in the last presidential election. So you might think that that is going to portend a moderate candidate, but we're seeing this year that might not necessarily be the case. Mm. There are a lot of progressive Democrats, especially who have, you know, big ideas about Medicare for all, things like that, that are gaining traction in some of these traditionally establishment districts.
Right.
So it'll be really interesting to see.
Yeah. And Claire, the latest on efforts by Alders to implement that hemp ban here in Chicago. Seems like we've been talking about that a lot lately.
The hemp saga.
The hemp saga continues. The city council tried and failed to override a mayoral veto.
Yes. So when we were first covering this, that sounded like there wasn't going to be enough support to even try to override the veto. As we know, just last week, Mayor Brandon Johnson vetoed that measure that would have banned most hemp products from being sold in the city, say that they're targeting kids and all that. So, yeah, then this was challenged officially. The veto override ended up failing by 8 votes.
Oh, wow.
So hemp is still here to stay until there's another challenge to this veto.
Or until the federal legislation.
Certainly. And that's something to watch as well.
Later this year. What else are you watching? Are you seeing what I'm seeing about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, or otherwise known as Prince Andrew?
Correct. So there has been a lot of speculation in the last couple of weeks about what will happen to those implicated by the release of the Epstein files. As we know, there is a sitting president with ties to the convicted sex offender, former past presidents, provosts of major universities, and Prince Andrew. Officially this morning, he was arrested by the UK government, or parliament rather, or cops, whatever you want to call them, the Scotland Yard of misconduct in public office. The British prince, as we know, was stripped of his royal titles because of his links to Epstein. And while Andrew has sort of consistently denied any wrongdoing in connection with his friendship, now concerns about his links to the late financier have sort of dogged the royal family now for more than a decade. But as Summer brought up this morning, King Charles III says the law must take its course.
Yeah, Summer's shaking her head
in this
investigation.
It's dramatic, but it is the first real action we've seen taken where there's been an arrest, not just a conversation, not just
like
a dialogue.
What else is going to happen with these? The folks involved in these Epstein files. Let's have some action.
Could
here.
Be setting a precedent.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Well, the fallout from this Epstein saga, Alex, is hitting kind of close to home. Thomas Pritzker, who's the cousin of J.B. Pritzker, our governor, is stepping down from his role as board chairman of the Hyatt Hotels because of his connection to the convicted sex offender. What do we know?
Well, we know that Thomas Pritzker has not been accused of any wrongdoing, but we also know that he exchanged nearly 24 emails over the course of years with Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, and he stepped down as chairman of the board. And he basically said that good stewardship also means protecting Hyatt, mm-hmm. particularly in the context of his association with Epstein. So that's basically where we stand at this point. The Sun-Times did a really good write-up on that. And I don't think we've heard from the governor on this. I mean, the governor's not involved in this at all.
Right.
And they're just family members. But as, you know.
I think he's trying to keep it that way.
Exactly.
On purpose, as I would too. Cousin? Are we really cousins? Summer, tell us about this new sport that made its debut today at the Winter Olympics in Milan. It's called ski mountaineering, or ski-mo, if you're inside. There's an Illinois athlete competing, too.
Totally.
What's the ski-mo stuff?
What is ski-mo? I feel like, well, first and foremost, I feel like there's been some really interesting sports added to the Olympics, whether it be summer or winter. Like, I'm still stuck on breakdancing being added. But yes,
let's
ski-mo.
Not revisit that.
But ski-mo, yeah. So it's a sport that combines mountaineering, where athletes hike or climb these snowy mountains and then backcountry ski down the mountains, essentially trying to figure out who can get up and down these mountains as fast as possible. There are a range of ski-mo events, 36 athletes competing in the 2026 wow. Olympics. But this year, the focus will be on individual sprints and the mixed team relay. Wow. And you know how Illinois likes to get down when it comes to sports. We have Cameron Smith, who's 30 years old, born and raised in Rockford,
nice.
Illinois.
Shout out to Cameron
Smith. Shout out to Cameron mm-hmm. Smith.
Ski-mo champ.
You know? So we have to see how he does. Those events will be starting. So the women's event will start at 2:55 in the morning. And then the men's will compete at 3:30 in yeah. the morning.
Well, I can't promise I'll be up for that.
You
but
know?
Yes, again, and I'm with you, Cameron. I'm rooting for you.
We're rooting.
Anyone have Olympic fatigue as we wrap here?
No.
No.
Yeah, absolutely
it's so good.
Not.
So good.
It's so good. And
I only get
like
to watch curling once every 4 years.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Also, go Canada. WBEZ, Summer Van Benton, Alex Degman, and Claire Lane.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yason, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.